You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koto katoa, ko jol toku ingoa, nau mai haere mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for Rapa Wednesday. I'm your host Joel and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producer Max. Ewhai ake nei coming up on the show. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March about the Green Party's call to Cabinet to drop the Regulatory Standards Bill after it concluded hearings at Select Committee, the government's decision to return 10 polytechnics to regional governance, and the Green Party's decision not to stand a candidate in this year's Tamaki Makaurau by-election. And I spoke with Ed Boswell-Correa from the New Zealand Nurses Organisation to discuss the cuts to services and patients at Tōtara Hospice. Max, what do you have for us today?
I spoke to Dr. Irish Jayawardena from the University of Auckland to talk about what action New Zealand should take to prepare for future floods. And I spoke to Nick Rawlins from the University of Otago to talk about Colossal Biosciences' project to de-extinct the South Island giant moa.
Here, aho whakaaro, I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātuhi mai, text it on 5395. Kaua e wareware e ahe koto, ana koto, te whakaronga ki e nei kōrero anō, hei pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te pai, tukutuku o irangi poho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Last week, the Green Party issued a statement calling on the government to drop the Regulatory Standards Bill after the bill went through hearings at the Select Committee, with only 19 out of the total 208 submissions heard supporting the bill. This week, the government confirmed their plan to re-establish 10 polytechnics that had been merged into Te Pukenga under the previous Labour government as part of the government's plan to gradually disestablish the wider institution. And the Green Party recently announced that they would not be standing any candidates of their own in the Tamaki Makaurau by-election, which are happening in September this year. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez-March to get the party's takes on all of these issues. What do you think the response to this bill through submission says about the bill and the next steps that should be taken?
People from all walks of life have come out rejecting David Seymour's neoliberal inequality increasing political agenda that is basically entrenched in the Regulatory Standards Bill that we're now scrutinizing. And this should be a wake-up call for the government to drop the bill and listen to people and the communities from all walks of life who have said no to more trickle-down economics that have only increased poverty and inequality.
How likely is it that the Select Committee will recommend that the House drops the Regulatory Standards Bill based on the submissions they've received?
Well, I am certain that the opposition parties will be calling on the bill to be dropped, and now the onus falls on the government parties to use their common sense and do the same. But again, Christopher Luxon seems to be quite happy to let David Seymour do the dirty work of pushing a neoliberal agenda only for him to then basically support it in the background. We've got to remember that under this government's watch, homelessness is on the rise, unaffordability is on the rise, and this bill will entrench those very same principles that allow for inequality to increase, and Luxon needs to show leadership and put this bill in the bin.
Speaking of David Seymour, Seymour has previously said that the majority of submissions opposing the bill don't reflect public opinion, even going as far as saying that 99.5% of opposing submissions were generated by bots. He later clarified to RNZ that he meant online campaigns that generated non-representative samples. How would you respond to that?
I think he's just full of it. Like, the reality is that when it's convenient for him, he'll amplify the voices of matters, and when it's not, he won't. The truth is that we have seen a group of people from all walks of life engaging in this process. Online guides can help people who have busy lives engage with these processes in a much easier way. And I think to dismiss as he has done, whether it's, for example, the everyday person working in hospitality to academics who have worked their whole life on issues in relationship to public law. David Seymour is just basically dismissing everyone and anyone who disagrees with him. And I think that shows that he's scared about the fact that the majority of people across the country don't want his trickle-down inequality-increasing politics.
What steps will the Green Party take to push back if the House doesn't drop the bill?
We're committing to repealing this bill as soon as we get into government. But beyond that, what we are committing to is also building an economy that works for everyone. It's not just good enough to repeal what the government has done. We need not just to change the government, but actually have a government of change.
Moving on to the next topic, the government recently confirmed their plans to re-establish 10 polytechnics that had been merged into Te Pukenga under the previous Labour government. The move would return the polytechnics regional governance and is part of the government's plan to gradually disestablish Te Pukenga. What was the Green Party's reaction to the government's re-establishment of those 10 polytechnics?
Look, the truth is that there hasn't been adequate engagement with our tertiary education sector. And I think vocational education is chronically under-resourced. And so with this move, what we are seeing is the potential for rural education to be impacted. And if we're serious about growing our domestic workforce, the government can't get away with both disestablishing Te Pukenga, but then not adequately resourcing vocational education that supports training our nurses, many of our tradies, and other professions that sustain our economy.
The government argues that restoring regional governance will allow different regions across the Motu to respond to local training and employer needs. Do the Greens see any merit in this rationale?
Not without adequate funding and not without recognising that, for example, many of the people who are training in polytechnics are expected to then do placements without getting paid. This is why we have been supporting campaigners like Bex Howell, who has been running a paid placements campaign. And it's important that the government does not just, disestablish Te Pukenga without then adequately addressing the barriers that exist for people to enter into vocational education.
Additionally, what impacts to the tertiary education system will come from Te Pukenga's disestablishment?
Will we risk rural communities losing access to adequate educational facilities for things like vocational training? And at a time when already we are seeing many people in rural communities having to basically move out of their hometowns to move to major urban centres to pursue education, I think it's important that the government commits to boosting the funding for vocational education, but also to support the students, many of them who are shackled with increasing debt and facing huge dropout rates from their careers because of the cost of living.
How would the Green Party like to see this addressed regarding the needs of Aotearoa's education system?
Yeah, look, I think there's merit in exploring things like paid placements. I think there's also an investigation we need to do around what does an adequately funded vocational education system look like. And at the same time, we need to support the staff and adequately pay them and adequately staff our vocational training institutes so that people can have the options to go into vocational training to support, growing our economy, growing an economy that actually works for everyone, and having enough jobs domestically so that we stop seeing people going to Australia because they see no future here in this country.
Lastly, it has been announced that the Tamaki Makaurau by-election will be held in September this year. However, the Green Party have announced that they would not be standing any candidates of their own when that happens. Can you tell us why the Green Party won't be standing a candidate in this year's by-election?
Yeah, look, first of all, I want to acknowledge the context in which this by-election is running, and we want to acknowledge Secretary Tash Kim's whānau, who are still grieving, but for us, it's a matter of resources, and we're still committed to Tamaki Makaurau. We're actually, for example, running a roadshow event in South Auckland this weekend, and we've done an event in the Shore as well the week before. We're going to put our resources into the general election, and we still think that people in the electorate deserve options and deserve adequate representation, which is why we encourage people to enroll and to get out and vote in this by-election, and we'll be contesting the general election as well.
This follows on from your previous point just then, but how is the Green Party advising its supporters to approach voting in the by-election?
We encourage people to participate in this democratic process. We think it's important, and we think it's also important for them to hold the candidates accountable for their commitments to ending inequality, to protecting our natural environment, fighting for things like ending homelessness and to have tangible solutions that will make people's lives better. And so, we want people to participate in this process, and we look forward to contesting the seat and the general election more broadly with solutions for an economy that works for everyone.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March speaking to us about the party's call to Cabinet to drop the regulatory standards bill, the government's decision to return 10 polytechnics to regional governance, and the Green Party's decision not to stand a candidate in this year's Tamaki Makaurau by-election.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
I don't know how to say this. Betelgeuse star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Betelgeuse.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Extreme weather events such as the recent Tasman floods are becoming more common in New Zealand. And with that, the risk of severe flooding is only increasing. The question is, how prepared is Aotearoa for the next severe flood and what action is needed to prepare for it? I spoke to Dr. Iresh Jayawardena, a lecturer in urban planning at the University of Auckland, to talk about New Zealand's lack of awareness when it comes to floods and why short-term planning has left many areas vulnerable to severe weather.
To start, can you explain why flood risk is increasing and how climate change plays a role in that?
It is obvious to us now, actually, that climate change is not a phenomenon or like a situation that we will be experiencing. It's a situation that we are already at. So I think flooding is a consequence of that. And the risk is like the global warming, unless we address to the original, where these causes of the climate change, the global warming address, the flooding and all the other risks that exacerbate with climate change will be, rising. So yes, definitely the flooding is a result of the global warming or the climate change, which we'll see mostly kind of commonly occurring in the future.
You've pointed out that much of our infrastructure in New Zealand is being developed in flood-prone areas. Why is that still happening in 2025, and what are the consequences of it?
Well, I think the climate change is fundamentally changing the way we have thought about, our infrastructure, our flood protection infrastructure. We planned, designed, and even managed them. So, as I said, the increasing frequency and the intensity of this flooding frequency and rainfall, and we will see more intense storm surges and, all these impacts that we see in the recent Tasman region will happen, frequently, which means that we probably have to change the way we thought about our designs, actually. So designs that maybe infrastructure that we have designed in the past may not be sufficiently adaptable to the ongoing risk or the increasing escalation of flood risk. So definitely we have to think about now designing infrastructure that could handle the increased flood risk from any, uncertainties or the impacts of climate change. And how do we design this infrastructure that could cope with the high, rainfall intensities and also for more frequent extreme events? It's something that we have to be taking into consideration as professionals.
How prepared would you say the average New Zealander is to respond to a flood event?
Well, I think the important thing is whether for the average New Zealand, the question is to me actually whether to how much the average in New Zealanders knows about their flood risk. So I think identifying whether their individual home or business is actually located in a flood-prone area and whether, if the local council is available any flood risk maps or any assessments that has been done is quite a good way to start. So I think the practical step for me in terms of like anyone who's particularly vulnerable to flooding, it could be like an individual, a community, a household. I think knowing the flood risk is really the first thing. And then I think it's just, knowing the flood risk and then everybody and the family members know what to do in a flood situation. Even having an evacuation routes or like some sort of emergency knowledge around how to respond to these events could be something that every average New Zealander now who's exposed to these floodplains need to know. I think it's very important that the community is aware of that sort of information.
You've mentioned the need for more awareness campaigns surrounding floods. What should these campaigns focus on, and who should be leading them?
Well, I think, I would think that now has becoming a responsibility of every individual, actually, because the question about climate change is like, you know, what causes and who's responsible for the impacts. So now when we're thinking about preparing for these floods events or any sort of emergency management requirements for natural hazards, it has to be a responsibility that blends with, I would say, you know, every individual has a role to play, and even government, like local government, district councils, regional councils, and even central government has to play a role to take initiative and what actions and the ways to, you know, to be prepared for these events. So I think the main thing is like every individual or community now need to know whether they are actually living in a place, you know, they're exposed to flooding. So that's like the important thing. And then thinking about from the government or like whoever the decision-making point of view, making good choices about where and what to build and where, you know, which especially infrastructure and communities that have exposures to flood risk is something that need to be aware of, and primarily, you know, avoiding building on floodplains or going for intensification in floodplains is really important.
If we were to look ahead, what kind of infrastructure changes or flood mitigation strategies do you think are most urgently needed in New Zealand?
Well, I think as we now going to see infrastructure, you know, is something that we really need as we go as population, as a country or as an economy. Infrastructure plays a huge part. So definitely having a resilient infrastructure is really important, which means resilient infrastructure that could cope to this sort of natural hazard events and then recover from and you know, adapt to actually from these events and then recover from this event. So having that sort of a resilient thinking is quite important, and we should be thinking about infrastructure that have direct, you know, resilient to, you know, this sort of situations. So priority actually should be given to considering more green infrastructure or design with nature that has the functionality to sort of cope with, you know, adapt to and recover from these sort of natural hazards. And also thinking about more holistic and a proactive approach to designing infrastructure with a more, through smart investments or even updated standards to what we used to do in the past to what we need to do in the future, given the uncertainty, we have to look at the level of risk this infrastructure would expose into. So that way, we need to have more adaptive or manageable infrastructure options actually to face this risk in the future.
Thanks, Irish. That was my final question. But was there anything else you'd like to add?
I think the most important aspect for everybody, especially decision making, like government or institutions who are responsible for taking actions to keep our community and infrastructure and our cities are resilient to climate change, is like actually thinking about where the existing knowledge sits from both community or local community point of view, as well as how we take that professional responsibility, even social responsibility, in our work to minimize these you know, natural hazard exposures to our community or to reduce the harm. So we have to think about making changes to the way we do our development, where we choose to do our development, and also taking high-level decisions actually at a very high level of uncertainty, especially regarding the climate change. So how do we take that decision that, you know, there's no regret in the future? So I think that will be the sort of thinking that we have to be processing at the moment.
And that was Dr. Irish Jayawardena on the action that New Zealand needs to take in order to prepare for more severe weather events and floods.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
They say that fashion is art, and you, lovely listeners, are the canvas.
That's right. We've been in the lab designing some sexy new merch for you to stay hot when it's cold and cool as hell when it's hot.
We've got new tees, hoodies, the classic BSA slogan, and a limited edition t-shirt of BFM's iconic weatherman, Rick Breeze.
So run, don't walk, to twotonesmerch.co.nz and get your grubby little mitts on the hottest new 95 BFM merch.
If music is the food of love, then we hope you're hungry, because you've got a ticket to the buffet.
Love language.
If music is the fuel of love, then vroom vroom, baby, it's time to hop on board.
Love language.
And if music is the language of love, then you better tune in to Love Language to stay literate.
Spend some quality time with your love language hosts, Carlotta and Scarlett. 9 to 11pm on the last three Saturdays of every month. Right here on 95BFM.
At this radio station, we do our utmost to abide by the Broadcasting Standards Authority and their rules and guidelines. If you seriously think we've crossed the line on air, give us a call on 309 4831 within 20 working days of the broadcast date and tell us about it. We'll be able to help you out and tell you the procedure if you wish to make a formal complaint to the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Fuck knuckles, cock and piss. Balls. Thank you.
I'm losing my edge. I'm losing my edge. The kids are coming up from behind. I'm losing my edge. I'm losing my edge to the kids from France and from London. But I was there. I was there in 1968. I was there at the first Cannes show in Cologne. I'm losing my edge. I'm losing my edge. To the kids whose footsteps I hear. When they get on the decks, I'm losing my edge to the internet seekers who can tell me every member of every good group from 1962 to 1978. Although I'm losing my edge, I'm losing all the kids to the art school of Brooklynites and Berlin and little jackets. Borrowed nostalgia for the unremembered 80s. Well, I'm losing my edge. I'm losing my edge. But I was there. I was there. Because I was there. I've never been wrong. I used to work song ever done by anybody. Every great song by the Beach Boys, all the underground hits, all the Modern Lovers tracks. I heard you have a vinyl of every Niagara record on German imports. I heard that you have a white label of every seminal Detroit techno hit, 1985, 86, 87. I heard that you have a CD compilation of every good 60s cut and another box set from the 70s. I hear you're buying a synthesizer and an arpeggiator and throwing your computer out the window because you want to make something real. You want to make a Yaz record. I hear that you and your band have sold your guitars and bought turntables. I hear that you and your band have sold your turntables and bought guitars. I hear everybody that you know is more relevant than everybody that I know. And you should know that this heat, there in the room, outside of the room, Nation of Ulysses, Mars, Jordan, the Black Dice, the Ty Terry, the Germ, Section 25, of the Adana, Section of the Rock Band, the Paradubo, Dorothy Ashby, Hills, Finding Your All-Stars, the Bart Hayes, the Human League, the Normal, Lou Reed, Scott Walker, Monk, Niagara, Joy Division, Lion Scientist, Sonic Force, just hit me one. Akin, Ben, Rogatia, David Axelrod, Electric Prunes, Gil, Scott, Heron, the Slit, Spouse, Mantronics, Barrow Sanders, and the Fire Engines, the Swans, the Soft Cell, the Sonic, the Sonic, the Sonic.
Get the saddest. Lately I'm hard to manage.
That was Homemaker by Sudan Archives. And before that was Losing My Edge by LCD Sound System. Welcome back to The Wire. You're on 95 BFM.
Is the plague at all a threat in the modern day?
No.
The Wire.
Recently, Totara Hospice in South Auckland announced they would be reducing their patient intake and services by almost a third due to funding gaps. This announcement follows a hiring freeze the hospice had put in place last month. The hospice helps provide end-of-life care at no direct cost to patients and is the subject of an upcoming documentary series called Hospice Heroes. While Minister of Health Simeon Brown has said that funding to the sector increased by 3% this year, representatives of the hospice have said that those figures weren't nearly enough to cover the costs of their services and that other palliative care centres across the Motu were experiencing similar pressures. I spoke with Ed Boswell-Korea from the New Zealand Nurses Organisation about the service cuts at Totara Hospice and how the sector at large is being affected. What is the New Zealand Nurses Organisation's response to Totara Hospice's decision to cut its patient numbers?
Yeah, you know, our response is really the concern about the funding issues, right? The fact that they're without the right funding, they're not able to sort of safely care for that many patients. It's not anything anyone wants to do, is to cut numbers down like this. And the people that are going to get cut from services are going to be the people who are early in their end-of-life journey, people who we could come on board with and help them get demystify death and dying for them, help them with symptom management of pain, anxiety, and just sort of gently get them down the line and across the threshold. Without being able to care for those people, what will happen is nurses will come on board very late, and the nurses and the care team will then have to scramble to get their person's symptoms under control. There won't be enough time to demystify death and dying for them. And so it's just going to be missing out on that gentler, softer approach.
You've briefly touched on this, but what are the factors that have led to patient cuts at Totara?
Yeah, so the reason is that the funding just hasn't really kept up with the increase of costs just across the board. If you look across the whole sector for hospices, they're about 50% funded by Te Whatu Ora, and the rest is through charitable donations. But because of the contract sort of staying stagnant for so long, the gap between Te Whatu Ora payments and charitable donations has grown bigger and bigger. And so we've just reached a point where they're having to cut back to just essential services only.
How many other hospices or palliative care centers are also reporting similar pressures?
You know, there's a couple in this area that are reporting similar pressures, and there were two up north of us that had restructuring last year because of these pressures already. So we're not the first, or Totara isn't the first sort of canary in the coal mine on this. There's already been some other ones that have had to do restructuring and look at who they're servicing for patient care.
Specifically at the Totara Hospice, how are frontline nurses and healthcare workers being affected by this decision?
Yeah, you know, I mean, just here, everywhere, no one's really happy about having to cut service numbers, because we know that with death and dying, getting in early is the number one thing, and talking to people, getting them accustomed to where the path's going to lead them, demystifying death. That's sort of the number one thing we do for people. And if we can't really get that service in place, it becomes a little frustrating for us, because we really want that. We want to make sure people are comfortable and that they're sort of had time to process their fears and anxieties. And if we can't get there on time, then again, we're just going to be scrambling for symptom management at the end of life.
Minister of Health Simeon Brown previously said that Health New Zealand had increased funding to the hospice sector by 3% this year. But is this enough to keep up with the needs of the sector?
No. Again, the gap has been widening as the years have gone on. And if you're talking about 3% on already less than half of funding, it's just not really enough, you know. It seems like it's gotten away from them. The funding increases have needed to be more and more as the years have gone on, and now we're sort of seeing it start to break down as it's piled up. The lack of accrual has piled up.
What would adequate and sustainable funding for palliative care look like from the New Zealand Nurses Organisation's point of view?
Yeah, as far as the numbers are concerned, I'm not an economist, but they're you'd have to talk to one of the people there about what the actual numbers would be. But for patient care, it would look like coming in early, making sure they're supported, making sure that they have things like social workers, physiotherapists, that they have counselors they can talk to, all these sort of wraparound services that help out, not just the bare essentials of pain management, and making sure that they get carers in place. You know, if somebody wants to die at home, they should have that option, but they should be supported in doing it.
If we're looking at what's happening at Tōtara Hospice, what does this say about how the hospice sector is heading forward just generally?
Yeah, I mean, generally, right, that's the big concern, right? If it's this is one hospice that's already saying that they're having to cut numbers, and there have been other hospices who've already had to restructure their nursing care or who get services, then I guess the concern is that this could just be more widespread throughout the whole sector, and we could be seeing more and more cutbacks as time goes on until it really is just essential services only. And then the other thing I should say is that the patients still need the services that we provide. Just because we're not able to do it anymore doesn't mean the need has disappeared. So those people are going to have to use ambulances, hospitals, their GPs, which are already overstrained.
That was Ed Boswell, courier from the New Zealand Nurses Organization, talking to us about the service cuts at Tōtara Hospice.
Oh yeah, let's rock and roll, man.
The Wire.
We'll be right back.
there is a disease which is tearing apart the lives of thousands.
Incentives there, give you an option, but I know you don't care. I'm gonna trick with a knife, a trick with a knife. It's about the time to take a hold.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. That was Trick with a Knife by Straw People, and before that was Froggy Forest Raceway by Baby Zionov.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
Back in April, American company Colossal Biosciences had announced a successful project, from their point of view, to de-extinct the direwolf. Now the company has teamed up with Peter Jackson, Canterbury Museum, and the Naitahu Research Centre to begin the de-extinction of the South Island giant moa. In April, we conducted an interview with Associate Professor and Director of the Paleogenetics Lab at the University of Otago, Nick Rawlins, who was displeased with the American company's attempts at the direwolf. Now to talk about the attempts at de-extincting the moa, I spoke to Rawlins once again.
We spoke with you a couple months ago about Colossal Biosciences project with the direwolf, where you had a largely negative opinion. Is this more of the same, or is this a step in the right direction?
Frankly, it's more of the same. While it is nice to see Māori and the Naitahu Research Centre involved in making these decisions around de-extinction, the engagement to date has been what you could call cherry-picking and not meaningful. So in all of the research that we have been doing on sequencing moa genomes in New Zealand ethically and in partnership with different Māori, iwi, hapu, runanga and trusts, there is no support for de-extinction across the motu, across the country. And so what this project really looks like is that Colossal and Canterbury Museum and the Naitahu Research Centre have cherry-picked their support. We have engaged with Naitahu Rūnanga across Te Waipounamu, the South Island, and there is no support for de-extinction. And if we take the giant moa, which they have said is the first species they want to de-extinct, giant moa also occurred at the top of the South Island in Te Tā Iho, which have 8 iwi there that we are working with, and they are all against de-extinction. So what I'm doing is actually calling on Colossal and Canterbury Museum and the Naitahu Research Centre to actually come clean about what level engagement have they done. Have they engaged widely amongst Naitahu? Have they engaged with other iwi on the South Island? And because they say they're going to sequence the genomes of all moa and eventually want to de-extinct them all, or attempt to, have they engaged wider? This is a conversation we need to have as a South Island as a whole, as a New Zealand as a whole, and not just captain's calls being made by a few individuals.
When we spoke about the direwolf situation, I asked you how important it was to consult Māori when it came to the de-extinction of animals in Aotearoa. It sounds like you wish that they talk to a couple more tribes. Are you satisfied with what Colossal Biosciences have done in that respect?
No, I don't think they have done anything properly. And when we've been talking with various Indigenous communities around Australia and North America, is we're hearing the same story, is that Colossal hasn't done due diligence and engaged properly with the communities, or listened to actually the various different opinions. So what I think they've done here is they've got some people on board. These people do not actually speak for the community as a whole, and they would need to do much wider engagement. It's one thing sequencing the genome or the genetic blueprint of extinct species from a bone from a swamp in the Rohi or tribal area of a Rūnanga. That is, say, the Rūnanga's right under their rangatiratanga. It's another thing going and de-extincting a species that occurred across the entire South Island. It can't just be down to one group of people.
You've been consistent in the viewpoint that we shouldn't be bringing back species to undo. Can you explain why?
So if we take the moa, there are some lost ecological connections that if you brought moa or a genetically mutated emu back, that they may be able to re-establish. But that would actually take sizable numbers of these moa to be released into the wild. And what the announcement has come out instead, well, they don't want to release them into the wild. They want to create the moa version of Jurassic Park and have ecotourism. So if you're going to release them, you need them to have a large enough population size so that they're not genetically inbred. You want the amount of genetic variation of your listeners in Auckland, not the amount of genetic variation of the English royal family or the Habsburgs. So you need several hundred, more than 500 individuals. So that's a self-sustaining population. We also don't know whether the de-extinct animals are going to be able to breed, what unintended consequences are. So there's a lot of ecological and ethical concerns. And for me, I don't think we should be bringing them back. We need to be able to learn from the mistakes of the past and actually conserve what we've got left and not drive more species to extinction, which would occur if you did bring de-extinct animals back. A lot are not going to be brought back because it's so expensive, and they would require conservation money, and that's going to pull money from trying to conserve and save other species, potentially driving them to extinction.
And you just called it the MOA version of Jurassic Park. Can you talk about Colossal Bioscience's plan to introduce their MOA into habitats?
So according to all the official press releases, is they're not going to reintroduce them back into the wild. So you wouldn't be able to go tramping in the Southern Alps and see MOA. What they want to do is de-extinct the South Island giant MOA, put it in a fenced ecological reserve. We've heard somewhere up the northern South Island, and they want to use that as an ecotourism opportunity to make money. And there's no plans to release these into the wild. I have heard talk that potentially this is being used also for food sovereignty, but I would argue against using MOA for food sovereignty. They are slow breeding animals. They have delayed maturity. The giant MOA takes about 3 years to reach adult body size and several more years to reach sexual maturity. And so it's not like standard domesticated farm animals, which are a lot quicker breeding. So I don't think this will provide food sovereignty either.
You've called Colossal Bioscience's plan to gift a baby MOA to Ngāi Tahu in 5 to 10 years a pipe dream. Why do you think this?
The technology doesn't exist yet. So if we take the dire wolf example, mammals are really well known genetically. We know their genomes. The dire wolf and the grey wolf are closely related to each other. What they did is they compared the genomes of those two species, and they're about 99% identical, so that's still over about a million differences. And they did 20 changes to 14 genes and created their genetically engineered grey wolves. Now, a bird is a lot harder. If we think of just the surrogates, giant MOA eggs are huge, and they're way bigger than an ostrich or an emu egg. So you cannot bring a giant MOA chick to term or full term, if we're thinking in pregnancies, in an ostrich or an emu egg. So they're going to have to develop artificial egg technology. The other problem is some of the birds like MOA are not what we call model organisms. They're not well understood. And so if we think of a MOA genome as about conservatively probably 1 billion individual letters long, that's your A, G, C's and T's of your genetic code, or Mr. DNA from Jurassic Park. And if we look at, say, the regions of the genome that we can directly compare, there's probably going to be about a 1% sequence divergence. So that's still going to be over 10 million differences between, say, an emu and a MOA. Now, Colossal has said is they want to completely genetically engineer an emu genome or another ratite genome to 100% match a MOA genome, so they have the MOA that Polynesians saw when they come to New Zealand. Now, that is a very, very tall order, and the technology isn't there. But there's also a whole lot of other what we call structural differences in the genetic blueprints, the way the genetic code is all packaged, that are equally as important and can't be recreated at the moment.
Lastly, does it concern you that if a de-extinction of the MOA was successful, that current endangered species in Aotearoa would be given less protection?
Yes. So if you're going to de-extinct the MOA, you're going to have to conserve it. And where is the money for the conservation of the MOA going to come from? How are you going to ensure that it's not attacked by dogs that we know that can take kiwi? They'll probably be able to take down juvenile MOA or chicks. how are we going to stop all the rat plagues that might predate eggs or chicks? How are you going to ensure that they're not genetically inbred and they don't have inbreeding depression, which is what is seen in kakapo? And that money has all got to come from somewhere. It could come from the Department of Conservation, or even if it comes from Ngāi Tahu, that's going to take away from other conservation that they are doing, for example, with kākāpō or with tākahē. So it will cause other species to go to worse conservation status and potentially extinction.
That was Nick Rawlins from the University of Otago on the project by Colossal Biosciences to de-extinct the South Island giant moa.
Yes, indeed. Oh, we're not passing judgment here.
Okay. It's just science.
It's just science, yeah.
The Wire. That was The Wire.
Ko ira te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I korero mai ki maua mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thank you to everyone who spoke with us today, the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, the New Zealand Nurses Organisation's Ed Boswell-Coria, the University of Auckland's Dr. Irish Jayawardena, and the University of Otago's Nick Rawlins. Nei rau hoki te mihi kia koutou e whakarongo ana. Thank you for tuning in. You're listening to 95BFM. Next up is the 1-4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.